project. Today, we are throwing it back to episode 201 with Dave Tilley. That is 2018. And Dave is basically a scientist when it comes to the shoulder joint specifically, but really gymnastics is kind of his specialty. And he's helping gymnastics education all around the world. So my partner, Ev, she's always following his stuff. And she told me that since you guys interviewed him, she did love the interview we did with him. He's actually released his own podcast. So if you go to shiftmovementscience.com/podcast, if you're interested in like very, very niche gymnastics topics, so some of them are like, when to progress young gymnasts and big skills, thoughts on gymnastics abuse scandal, so stuff like that. Just kind of really, really intricate niche stuff on gymnastics. He has a podcast on that. Our stuff that we talk about is a little bit broader, but his company, Shift Movement Science, has some really good, Shift Movement Science has some really good stuff on their blog and articles and just their Instagram and Facebook as well. So make sure you enjoy that stuff. Guys, before we jump into the episode today, we are brought to you by True Protein. True Protein, basically the best supplements in the game, and definitely in Australia. They call it the natural edge. That's just because all the people that are on the True products are natural athletes. A lot of supplement companies don't use natural athletes. I don't know if they have some kind of like testing policy. I know Raph was tested for all kinds of different steroids, but I was like, nah, guys, trust me, that booty is natural. If you guys want to go to True Protein and order any of their amazing supplements, it's trueprotein.com.au. It's Mind Muscle 10 when you check out. Obviously, the whey is the most popular product. There's no way you can't have it. So, guys, let's jump into this episode with Dave Tilley. This is Lachlan Rouston.
This is Raph Friedman, and you're listening to the fittest podcast in Australia,
The Mind Muscle Project. Welcome back to the show, Mind Muscle Project. Today, we have on Dave Tilley. If you remember back to episode 98, we're looking at the poster now, we had Dave's good friend Dan.
2 short years ago.
Yeah. Dan Pope. Now, a lot of you OGs will remember that episode. It was a great episode on like a lot of stuff on pull-ups and like shoulder performance and that sort of thing. So we will get into some of that stuff today, but I'm also interested in some of the science of stretching. Dave's also belongs to the Power Monkey Fitness crew. And he's got a gymnastics background. He's done some interesting stuff with like gymnastics in the US with younger athletes as well. And he is coming to Australia in Perth, unfortunately. But for all our Perth listeners, you should be stoked. And that is coming up. When's that coming up?
I'm going there in November.
November. So
if my visa gets approved, that's still to be determined.
Yeah, it's unlikely, but
it's pretty easy to get into Perth.
Yeah. Perth has different laws. So today we really want to go over some like shoulder stuff, gymnastic stuff, and some of the science of stretching. So I definitely missed some holes. Can you give us a little bit more background information, Dave, on some stuff I may have missed?
Yeah. So first of all, just thanks for having me on. I mean, I love doing these things and getting to kind of chat with people who are kind of in the trenches, so to speak. So my elevator pitch is I always tell people that I was a gymnast long before I was a physio or before I was, involved in CrossFit. I did gymnastics my whole life, competed in college. I've been coaching for 10 years, younger athletes, men's and women's, anywhere from like the high school to the college level. And went to PT school. Did my doctoral work and then did postdoctoral work in just sports physical therapy, just specifically for 2 years. It's not like a residency. It's just like a 2-year understudy. And then I got my strength conditioning license after that. So I kind of work as a physio in sports and I also work as a strength conditioning coach. And I still actively coach gymnastics while I treat, and I do CrossFit and just like meathead kind of fitness myself too, a lot of gymnastics stuff. So I kind of live in all three of those kind of hats, so to speak, athlete a little bit still, not nearly as competitive as I used to be just kind of for health, but that, and then coaching and medical provider at a facility called Champion Physical Therapy in Boston. And then I got linked up with Power Monkey just because of, gymnastics background, and Dave was a big idol of ours looking up. So he was moving into helping the fitness world learn how to do gymnastics a little bit better. And I got involved with Power Monkey. I'm still on their staff. And I'm a massive nerd. I work a lot, which is cool, but I like to help people. And, the last 2 years, 3 years has been a lot more involvement with CrossFit athletes of all levels, from like just walked in the door, started CrossFit, want to like not hurt my back and pick my kids up, to, super high level going to the games. And I was fortunate to do some of that work last year.
Yeah, awesome.
That's it. That's me.
That's a long, extensive background of training. I'm interested for sort of like a personal thing at the moment. How did you find when you were obviously taking your competitive gymnastics mentality? I assume there was a bit of a a break maybe between like your competitive years and finding CrossFit? Maybe there wasn't. But how did you find that transition when you found something like CrossFit and you could put like more competitive energy from your gymnastic days into like a new sort of field of training?
Yeah, totally. That's a great question. So I did 4 years in the States here. We have 4 years eligibility for the men's program that I was with. So I did my 4 years of competing in a 3 years undergrad, 1 year doctoral work. So I was already kind of transitioning to PT school. And for like 2 years, I would say after being done with gymnastics, I was pretty much like the average gym goer, you know, just like routines offline, just doing some gymnastic stuff, like whatever kept me moderately in shape. But I really felt like it was like, it always felt like a little bit short of the stimulus I was trying to get. And it's only like got so repetitive, you know? So it was actually when I moved to the North Shore of Boston, it's completely serendipitous that a couple of the coaches that I was working at the gym at were Olympic lifter, at the gym down around the corner called the North Shore CrossFit, which is originally, like you talk about OGs, like my buddy, Dave Picardi, who owns it. I think he has like the 40th affiliate in the world. He was one of the original like people that went to Glassman cert and like saw it face value. And like, he's been around forever, like 15, 16 years. So he knows this stuff like inside and out. He's seen the trends come. He's seen the game start from the ranch to what it is now. And he's seen everything in between. So I just happened to walk into a really good gym with him. And then the Olympic weightlifting coach at the time was actually Matt Frazier's old coach from the OTC. So okay. I learned some stuff from him, and Andy Tisch has now moved on. But there's just like a lot of roots kind of at that gym from where they come from. So I just kind of got a firing hose of information about that. And I just slowly kind of trickled into doing classes. And, you know, at first, I think as most people do, I was way too competitive, just an idiot, you know, like really good at gymnastics, obviously, but I looked like Bambi on thin ice trying to Olympic lift. So it was awful. And, went through a 6 month of that. And then I was like, okay, I'm not a competitive athlete anymore. Made the decision, like, I just don't really want to be competitive anymore. So it transitioned to much more about just health and fitness and just pushing myself. And now it's become a routine where I'm able to just like, be competitive with myself, but I really put tunnel vision on to honestly anybody in the class or around me. I just do my own workouts and do my thing just to kind of feed my academic pursuits now.
Yeah, we actually know Dave personally. He we're a part of
Okay.
Yeah. We're a part of the Mad Lab coaching team.
Yeah.
We coach the Australian clients.
He's been on the podcast actually.
Yeah, Dave has been. Yeah, he's actually been on the show.
That is a hilariously small world.
Did you become like a Mad Lab client? Did you have a coach and all that sort of thing? Did you go through that in early stages?
No. Oh, yeah. So Derek Goff, when I first started, he was my personal coach. He's one of my best friends now. But Dave and Derek together kind of were dual onboarding me, I guess, a little bit. Because I mean, as soon as I learned about who Dave was and where he went from, and Andy especially, I was like, I'll pay you or give you as much coffee as you need for you to tell me about, you know, what you know. Yeah. At that time, I was just starting my strength and conditioning degree too. So I was going through formal CSCS training and reading the textbooks, but I wanted like more information. So I did a version of that, I would say. And then I had Derek as a coach for a long time, and Dave's written two or three of my Olympic weightlifting programs and coached me. So.
Yeah, I always find that so interesting when you bring, like it happens with us as well, but it's very rare that you bring on a client and they become, well, obviously as the coach, you're mentoring them and they are studying strength conditioning, they are studying personal training, but they're not quite in the industry just yet and they want to like be a sponge. And it's awesome because you're kind of like in this world where they're like, oh, you know, this is what I learned in the classroom today. And then you're like, oh, cool. That I get that, but like this is what actually works, and then you can kind of give them the anecdotal evidence, so they're kind of getting the washing machine of both, which is interesting. How much of the like stuff you were learning in the books and the textbooks did you find was conflicting, or you know, kind of getting kind of butting heads with the stuff that Dave and what was it, Jeff was
Derek.
Derek was giving you
Derek. Yep. I would say it wasn't butting heads, so to speak, is that it just like the dots weren't connected, you know? So like they had their, I mean, Andy Tisch, especially, Andy's like one of the most gangster originals of weightlifting. And he taught education at the OC here. So it's like, okay, that's pretty big deal. So it wasn't like he was wrong. It was more just what he was saying wasn't how the textbook writes it. You know, when he uses certain cues or when he writes programming, he has like master level periodization in his head, but he doesn't call it undulating wave periodization. He doesn't call it drop sets. You know, he just like does his thing and he knows from years of experience about what makes athletes adapt. So I feel like because Dave and Andy were so heavy into Olympic lifting, once we had a conversation about it and I was like, okay, well, like I think this is what you're trying to say from a technical point of view. And like, this is what I read about. Like, it's like, oh yeah, we're saying the same thing. So, and this is the same thing I went through with Jay Lydon too, because Jay's a really, really intelligent guy. And usually it's like, you get confused for a moment. And then when you're like, what do you think? What do I think? What are you trying to tell me to do? And like, why are we doing it a certain way? It usually all works out pretty well. I say there were a few things that were more just trying to clear the air about like metabolic energy systems and more the tissue level effects of like strength training adaptations, of soft tissue adaptations, that I was just like really in the rabbit hole about, that I was trying to bring up and like learn more about. But it wasn't like it was conflicting, you know, it was more just like convoluted.
Did you ever get to a point with just sort of CrossFit? Now, I can't imagine Dave's gym would ever program ridiculous stuff nonstop year round, obviously, because he's very intelligent. But were there aspects of CrossFit where you started to question it? And then, you know, with the accumulating skills that you had as a practitioner, you start to think to yourself, I don't know if this is a good idea, or maybe we need to do this another way. Was there any things like that that you had?
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that they came mostly from the gymnastics point of view, because of how much of a coach that I was. Like, I've never done a kipping handstand pushup.
Yeah.
Just like, it's not in my blood. Like, I did it a couple times for workouts and I was like, meh, you know, but that's more just like my background and my understanding. So there were a lot of things technically that I think that, and again, I've never taken an L1. I've never taken something like that. There were just things that they were teaching people to do that, from a gymnastics fundamentals point of view of where I came from 20 years as an athlete, I was like, I don't think I agree with that as a technical point of view, because you're not doing strict work first, and you're not doing midline hollowing perfect in a pull-up before you do any swinging. So I don't know if it was more that I was fed up. It was just like, I just didn't really agree with what I was trying to do in terms of teaching people. But then obviously, like, 5 years later, it came out with Power Monkey that Dave was doing the same thing with the college guys, with a lot of the elite gymnasts that are now at Power Monkey camp. So it was kind of like, oh, I understand now. And it wasn't Dave's gym. Dave was like very strict on like the proper progressions. It was more just the bird's eye view of everything going on in the fitness world.
Yeah.
And it seemed like when I talked to Chad and Jody Vaughn, that was being echoed with the Olympic lifting world. So, I mean, there's things personally that I don't do in CrossFit, because I don't think that I'm, you know, ready for them. Like, I don't heavy Olympic weightlift under fatigue. I don't do certain skills under fatigue, because I just think that's me. That's not, I mean, maybe it's a CrossFit thing, but I think it's just me and my ego.
What are some of the other skills that you don't do?
I don't do high rep or high load fatigued Olympic lifting. Like, yeah. I won't like 1 RM a snatch after a long Metcon.
Yeah.
Like, I rarely max out, except unless it's in a strict Olympic lifting program and my coach has told me that I can, or someone has told me that I look good. I also don't do a lot of the same repetitive movements in the same week, you know. Like, I really break up my training. I probably do a couple Metcons per week, and then I do a lot of traditional Olympic lifting stuff, but then I do a lot of just general strength conditioning, like things that, movements you wouldn't see in CrossFit, I mix in quite a bit twice per week to kind of accessorize my training, so that I kind of stay healthy, just from the PT world, especially with like shoulders and like my low back, which I think is what we do with a lot of athletes and that come to us anyway. So
yeah, it's definitely drifted into that rehab, prehab, sort of integrate into the warm-ups, integrate into the program for the general pop. And then it seems like the gyms that aren't doing that sort of stuff, those clients are leaving and ending up at the gyms that do it. And they're like, hey, like, my body's fucked. Like, can you help me out? Or they come, or it goes the other way. They're like, hey, I'm looking for more of a challenge. I'm super broken. And they come to your gym and they're like, this is too slow. It's not enough volume. I'm not pushing myself hard enough. And they give up and they do something else, like, where they can still get that intensity, but they don't need to Olympic lift, or they don't need to do something heavy. They just need to work hard. So yeah, it's an interesting transition the industry is making. Have you guys got F45 yet in Boston?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
It's kind of like, you just like take out everything difficult from the CrossFit workout and just
anything
do it
that needs coaching.
Yeah. And then just do it for 45 seconds on, 15 seconds off
for 45 minutes
every day.
Yeah.
It's like hardcore interval training.
Yes. Yeah. It's like hardcore repetitive circuit training. Yeah, so prepare for repetitive elbow injuries and shit in America very soon.
Yeah, and the problem with those places you find with the good CrossFit gyms, like you were saying, people after a while, they often start doing like their own extras, and it's like a culture of like, if your gym doesn't program it, you end up having to just do it yourself. And you see people like before and after class, or like getting your programs and doing that before and after. But with a lot of those gyms, like even that is like not really allowed in the gym.
Yeah.
Like, you're there to do the circuit and go.
Yeah.
And there's like no room, because they're not allowed to do personal training.
Yeah.
So there's just like no possibility of you even trying to do something good for you or something like extra.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So along
we're seeing that now. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, sorry, along those lines, for a person that's taking on their own prehab and rehab stuff, before we talk about what they should be doing, what should they not do anymore? I feel like the bands and the foam rollers, not only far less, well, they're pretty much one of the most unpopular things in our gym because we don't really use them anymore for stretching, but what kind of stuff are you just seeing that's just not really relevant anymore or doesn't give you much of an effect?
Yeah, so I guess before I step into the conversation is that I, in no way, shape, or form is there any one person that I'm like subconsciously alluding to that's not, you know, someone we shouldn't follow. I think that the way the medical, this is always what happens. Dan and I do a podcast, like, what do you think about Kelly Starrett? Like, what do you think about Ramwad? And I'm like, dude, that's not what I'm trying to do is chop the legs out of people. Yeah. Because you don't make progress unless you have, you see something, you try it, and you be like, okay, that didn't work, that did work, how do we tweak it, right? Like, none of the information that we're using now would exist if people didn't have the courage to step up and try something new. So I respect those people, and they've done a lot of stuff to help the industry, but you know, science evolves and things like that. So I guess from my point of view is the work that I've been exposed to from my boss is Mike Reinold, and he was the head trainer for the Sox for a long time, and he's pretty legendary and definitely in the shoulder in terms of like rehab and like how to take care of your shoulders at a professional athlete level and what you need to do. And like their work over like 25 years of like pretty hardcore high level science, data driven, very research based, says that one of the biggest things in the shoulder you want to really do is make sure that you're stressing the soft tissue in terms of mobility work, and that you're not stretching the passive structures like the labrum, the ligament, the joint capsule, you know, and the bony structure. And I think that if you really take a pretty deep dive into the literature and you look at like how the shoulder is designed, there's different positions of the shoulder that stress the joint capsules different ways, right? So not to get overcomplicated, but if I have my arm by my side and say I'm at 45 degrees, it's hard to see, but you guys don't care, but it's 45 degrees, right? That stretches a different portion of my anterior capsule and the inferior band a little bit more. But if I elevate to 90 degrees and I externally rotate, it stretches more the inferior capsule and the anterior humeral ligament, right? It's not like all just one thing. So based on how your arm is positioned, you're going to stretch different portions of the joint capsule. If I do internal rotation, it's the posterior band. And if I elevate fully, it's like inferior and a little bit of anterior. But based on those studies that we've seen, and you know, that surgeons do this when they put someone under anesthesia and they repair your labrum, they repair all that stuff. They're testing the capsule. They're testing how loose you are. If you have more collagen and you stretch out more, you're more loose jointed and you can get into positions. So sometimes the long answer to this is that people are doing stretches that are not necessarily based on the very complex anatomy and biomechanics of what shoulder research shows us. They're doing based on like what looks really cool on Instagram, and they're doing them based on what they think is helping them, you know? And it's like a brutal honesty that like, people's videos go viral over, you know, it's not just bands, it's over everything, right? That people's videos go viral instead of being like, okay, well, what is like 20 years of shoulder research and data on cadavers, labral repairs, and people who actually get hurt, and then people that we see that actually get rehabbed back to full health? Like, what does that say? And that's harder because that's longer, it's way more work, and it's way less profitable,
right?
But that's the problem that, and I don't know if that's a user error, if that's like the person's fault because they're not taking the time to see a healthcare provider who's qualified, or if that's maybe the information drip problem of mass media, or if that's honestly people who are putting information, you know, and making money ahead of people's health and like the grunt work that it takes to be educated. So we see tons and tons of people in our clinic who, you know, have the start of a shoulder injury probably because they just put too much volume, they spiked their volume, they started a new program, and they didn't really do the right fundamental work first. And then they get a little sore and they literally just grab a YouTube video, start stretching with a band, or they start just tugging on it with like a foam roller, or they start doing some crazy stuff that, you know, looks like it's out of like the medieval torture chamber, and they think they're helping themselves, and they wake up the next morning and like, dude, I feel awful, right? And they come to us and it's like, well, you know, like maybe, you know, you should have just seen someone first. And there's an error on the physio side too. There's a lot of physios who have no idea what's happening in a front rack position with the joint capsule, but they're giving somebody mobility work, you know? So that's a long answer, but I think the long and short is that it's like, you have to get an assessment. You have to address the soft tissue. And if you really do have a problem with the capsule, which is definitely a possibility, if you're like a little older, you had surgery, there's a very specific way to get about getting that capsular mobility back. And if you do it the wrong way, like you can really jack yourself up bad.
Mm. Yeah, that's actually interesting. Like with, I played some, you know, one-sided sports like baseball and stuff, which is very rare in Australia, but and tennis, but it definitely changed the anatomy of my shoulder because I did it so young. And then obviously you go and do something like Olympic lifting and it requires a lot of symmetry, really. And because you've got the asymmetry, we actually had, you know, we always talk, okay, how would we balance it out? How would we fix this, that? And then I think it was Sean from Active Life was saying that, you know, basically you've changed the internal structure or how the labrum works, but just from, you know, thousands of serves and thousands of, you know, pitches or whatever, to the point that they may, it may never look the same in an Olympic lift ever. What are your thoughts on something like that?
Yeah, right. So my boss wrote that research and he did the studies that showed those changes, right? So in Birmingham, Alabama, they take an ultrasound to the growth plate of young throwers and they look at, it's called retroversion or humeral retroversion. So how much your growth plates allow your bone to warp backwards. Mm. And when young baseball athletes, javelin, you know, handball, when they play toss from a young age, their growth plates warp back a little bit and that allows them to get more layback. And what that does is it retroverts the humeral head into the growth plate and it allows more layback into ER, but it subsequently causes you to lose IR, right? It causes your bone to not be able to warp forward unless you have accessory scapular motion or you're starting to get like compensation from somewhere else. So yeah, it's a perfect example, right? And I've talked with Chad Vaughn a lot about this too, is like someone who has a ton of external rotation here and no IR, right, is going to have a really hard time getting a smooth bar path for internal rotation to get a snatch to be very, very close or to power, like to get a clean very, very close. So if someone who has a shifted total arc of motion, right, that person's going to have a really tough time getting the bar close. That might lead to some shoulder issues on that side, right? Because if you can't have internal rotation, you may place the humeral head anterior, you might get some biceps irritation, right? And that's what happens is people, you know, get IR losses and maybe this is a physio or a doctor like, oh, you have GERD, glenohumeral rotation deficit, do the sleeper stretch, right? And like get your GERD back, right? They're never going to get their internal rotation back, right? Mm. It's going to be, it's bony humeral retroversion. It's never going to come back. And if they do have a loss of IR, and this has been research that my boss did with MLB and what Dan and I think is actually happening in CrossFit athletes now is repetitive deceleration of your arm, eccentric stress to the back of your shoulder causes soft tissue stiffness from throwing, right? Or I think from slowing down a barbell, doing touch and go reps, like slowing down the barbell to your hip, which is what a lot of people do, is the same eccentric trauma to the back of your shoulder that a deceleration throw in baseball does. And that does has been shown to accumulate soft tissue stiffness in the back of your shoulder that can limit IR over time. So Mike, when he was with the Red Sox, would have somebody throw a pen, measure their IR before and after and show like a 10-20 degree loss, but soft tissue work to the posterior cuff, teres major and posterior infraspinatus would restore that motion with cross body stretching, right? And then Dan and I started doing this with some high level regional and games athletes that we did, is that they would be training for regionals for the games, and but I would see them measure their IR. They would come back 2 days later after doing a bunch of chest to bars or touch and go stuff, and I would take a peek at their IR again, and it would go away a ton. So people who seem to do a lot of heavy pull up volume and a lot of touch and go volume seem to lose their IR bilaterally, and it's soft tissue adaptations. You know, it's not bony humeral retroversion, but trying to crank on your cuff is probably not going to be a good idea. We've restored people's IR between workouts and between weeks pretty well, and their shoulder pain, their shoulder feels a little bit better. Mm. So. Huge long answer to how that
lands. No, that was good.
CrossFit, but
that was good.
Yeah, that's the theory right now. And Dan and I see that over and over and over with people who are either only doing mobility work that might be a little misguided. Some people are right in the money, don't get me wrong. And they just don't do follow-up strength and technique work. But there's a lot of people who are, you know, have soft tissue adaptations in their shoulder from just volume, you know, and we're learning now through we see more athletes over the long course of the year. We're seeing what movements do to people, right? Repetitive pull-ups and repetitive rope climbs seem to really overwork teres major in the lat, and that may affect your overhead elevation, right? Repeated toes to bar, knees to elbows, those kind of things may get your adductors and your inner thigh a little bit stiff, and you got to manage that soft tissue. If you don't, you're probably going to stretch out your joint capsules to make up the difference and cause some irritation to your shoulder or hips, or you might just, you know, slowly lose your basic movement patterns.
Mm. Yeah, that was interesting, that explanation. Just for people to clear, IR is internal rotation. So it's like if you were going to throw a ball, like you said, it's the end part of the ball where your arm finishes, like how much internal rotation you have there. And to be frank, most people downstairs in our gym have very,
zero.
Very, yeah, very little. Very little. Even when they walk in for the first time, just very little.
Right. And again, think about normal, like let's think about the 95% of CrossFit athletes, right? The people who are just working out to be healthy, maybe be competitive, right? Most chances are when they've walked into the gym, they don't have an Olympic background, right? Olympic lifting background. Maybe they played a throwing sport when they were younger, but they also don't have a gymnastics background. And all three of the Olympic lifting and gymnastics require quite a bit of mobility in general, but definitely overhead elevation and internal rotation, right? Like layback's a unique thing to throwing athletes in the ER, but most people aren't going to have it to begin with. And then most people are going to do a lot of volume of the the repetitive movements in CrossFit that are very indicative of teres major stiffness, pec and lat stiffness, right? Chest to bar, muscle ups, toes to bar, all those things are like lat teres, right? And those progressive adaptations in soft tissue are thought to limit IR and elevation if they get too far gone, along with the posterior cuff. And I see this all the time in people who think about how many pushing and overhead movements are there in CrossFit compared to direct horizontal pulling volume. Besides the erg rower, right? Besides maybe if you get accessory work with barbell movements and maybe a couple other things here and there, it's like probably like a 6-to-1 ratio of pushing and overhead movements to direct scap pulling. Man, you know? So just doing rotator cuff stuff, you need to do some heavy, heavy horizontal pulling to balance out some of that volume, and you need to manage your soft tissue adaptations. And that's what Dan and I do a lot in the clinic, from the work that Mike and Lenny have done with baseball, is just finding out the unique motions that we know from gymnastics and Olympic lifting and trying to restore those motions through soft tissue and heavy, heavy strength work for their cuff and for their scap. Like, people leave our clinic and their arms are roasted, but in a good way, like a heavy strength program.
Wait, so you said it's all lat teres, but isn't a horizontal pull a lot of lat and teres as well?
Right. So if you elevate your arm up, you get a little more middle trap, lower trap, and rhomboids, right? So if you get like a direct, think about like the opposite of a push-up, right? If you do a push-up, right, if you flip yourself over, put a rack in a very low position, feet up on a box, and you put your elbows higher and you row straight to your face like a face pull,
right,
that maybe gets some more lat and teres, but it biases middle trap, lower trap, and rhomboids, right? Wise, direct, wise, and overhead pulling is more lower trap based on the fiber angulation, but middle trap, lower trap, and direct scap work, and then some serrated stuff from an opposite kind of pressing motion. But most people do ring rows with their elbows down by their sides, or they do one-arm dumbbell rows, which are moving in the right direction because it's in that force vector, but straight face pulling, right? Like face pulls, feet elevated rows, bent over barbell rows that are strict, chest elevated, you know, rows, putting a bench up on two boxes, doing direct seal rows, you know, all those things are probably grossly overlooked in a lot of the athletes that we see. And it tends to cause performance issues, right? They can't have proper stacking position for jerks and for handstands or handstand pushups, but they also can't get their arm over their head without a lot of soreness.
Mm. So that's like where your elbows are directly out to your sides, because everyone, I think, gets pretty obsessed with like tucking their elbows in on any sort of pulling motion, mm-hmm. or even pushing, where their elbows are like mm-hmm. almost touching like their obliques, the side of their body. And what you're saying is they need to do more stuff where their elbows go directly out to the sides.
Yeah, and I think the reason that so many people move away from that kind of more wider position, and we're not talking about like, you know, super elevated, it's kind of maybe 80 degrees of abduction, 20 degrees of elevation right in the front of scaption, because that's how the glenoid faces. But when you do that, right, you don't want to row so far that if you have mobility restrictions in your pecs or in some other areas that you get anterior humeral glide, right, that you pull so hard that you turkey neck and your shoulders roll forward. And that's what a lot of people do. And so when they start to do that, it hurts, right? But that's not so much that's more the exercise selection is a big part of it. And it's also the cueing and the coaching of that. But like most people can get relatively close with a good like motion of their scaps, get neutral humeral glide in a chin tuck position and not have too much cranky shoulders. But like a lot of the heavy cuff work that we give to people, especially for performance stuff, like any pro athlete that we work with is getting a pretty extensive hypertrophy of the cuff program and hypertrophy of horizontal pulling to balance out and keep their shoulders safe. It's just basic arm care for anyone who uses their shoulders at a high level. But that's the same thing we give to, you know, basic CrossFitters who are just trying to hang for the first time or trying to do stuff on their hands, right? Like handstand pushups are, these are non-weight bearing joints. Your body doesn't have a meniscus in your shoulder or elbow that's going to force absorb. You have to do extra work to make your cuff to be extra strong. You have to do very, very hard, aggressive hypertrophy work for the stabilizers of your shoulder because the passive stabilizers won't hold up.
That's interesting. So you're saying that CrossFit athletes have basically overdeveloped lats and teres because they do a lot of stuff on the bar with fixed hands. We've had Julian Pinot come on from StrongFit. I don't know if you're familiar with his stuff. And he's kind of saying the opposite. He's saying CrossFit athletes at a high level, what he's observed is their lats are very weak. And they're
saying their upper backs are really big.
Yeah, their traps are overdeveloped and their lats don't work. But you don't seem to think that's the case.
So I do, in a way. I would say that there's a different categorization, right? I think that CrossFit athletes have overdeveloped muscle imbalances. And I would say that if anything in their weakness, I don't think it's like a concentric pulling. I think they're eccentrically weak through full range of motion. I think most athletes are going to be training a moderate to partial range of motion, either because it's harder to do strict, you know, eccentric heavy tempo work. Like think about the bottom of a dip. How many people do tempo pause dips and hold the bottom for 10 seconds to prepare their shoulders for muscle ups before they ever start swinging? right? Not a lot, right?
Well, usually the first time you get to the bottom is your first muscle up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good.
Right. And that's what we teach at Power Monkey Camp, is that you should do bottom position holds on parallettes that are stable, then top positions, and then eventually over 6 months, you work into a ring support hold, then you work into the top of a ring support hold, then you do 5-5-5 tempo pause dips to make sure you don't hurt your pecs, right? And you slowly work up to it. And going back to the original question, what I've observed, and this is just a sample that I have, is that I do find that people are weak in their lats and things like that over nature, over time, but I don't think it's because the muscle itself is just weak and under hypertrophied. I think it's because they've been cheating themselves with poor technique for so long that they haven't maintained like a true hollow position in a pull-up, or they haven't maintained a true armpit forward overhead jerk position for so long that now they're starting to rely on other things, right? So now, instead of being truly in a hollow and a stack position when I jerk, when I handstand push-up, I'm head out, slightly checked in my shoulders, and I'm arched in my core, right? So now, instead of doing a proper stacked handstand push-up with my elbows tucked, which is how they teach at Power Monkey, and doing 7 months of grunt work that's boringly brutal, right, to get a proper tripod position, people are just jerking from their back, right? Or they're pushing from their back. So, I mean, I would say that I definitely see more people who have teres stiffness, because rope climbs, muscle ups, and all of those things are very teres dominant, the direct pulling and horizontal, you know, or overhead adduction down to your side. In terms of lat stiffness, I see a lot of lat stiffness. I think that when people do assessments on the table, if you get somebody in a truly externally rotated position and you don't allow rib flaring and you really get them overhead, I tend to see people who are more stiff than weak. But I also see a ton of athletes that are super mobile in their joint capsules, and they get away with extra mobility they don't know, you know, necessarily how to use technically. So I guess that what I'm trying to say is that, especially in that area, I would say my bias is towards stiffness over weakness. But I do think that eccentric strength, like a heavy eccentric pull-up, that's the best way, through research has shown eccentric-wise, to get sarcomerogenesis and actually make your muscle longer, along with many, many other tools. But I think that that's the strength that people lack, not just a brute 1 RM, you know, if we put you on a force dynamometer and pulled you down, but can you tolerate eccentric overload? That's probably where people would fall apart. The trap issue is of overdeveloped upper traps, I totally agree with, right? Because people are shrug dominant in Olympic lifting, and people are doing a lot of pulling motion. But when you don't have shoulder elevation, the first thing you do to cheat it is to put your head forward, or you shrug, right? You shrug your upper track to get pure elevation instead of getting upward rotation and posterior tilt, right? So instead of your scaps floating naturally up your shoulder, you just get here. And like, you think about the person you tell a jerk with a proper position and they can't, what do? They go like this, and they push the bar up as high as they can, and their head comes forward.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of people get overdeveloped upper traps because of Olympic lifting, right? Naturally, that's, again, back to the soft tissue adaptations we see in Olympic lifters. Like, they just over time get stiff traps. But a lot of people, your general fitness population people, will shrug upward, right? Or put their forward head position to make up that last 20% of range of motion, because they lack it from true thoracic mobility or neck mobility or overhead or muscular imbalances like that. So that's where I tend to see a lot of upper trap, you know, hypertrophy that's overworked, is because the fibers of your trap, your upper trap, middle trap, and lower trap, are not balanced, right? So instead of getting smooth upward rotation with posterior tilt, you get straight elevation. And that goes back to the original conversation about why horizontal pulling volume is so important, because with all three fibers working with your serratus, you get pure upward rotation and posterior tilt, which tips your glenoids up and gives you less acromial impingement.
Okay.
So sorry if that was the most epic nerdy answer.
No, that was
time,
good.
But
that was good. Well, look, put it this way. We just had probably the nerd of all nerds, like the king of the nerds in terms of energy system training.
Leader of nerds.
Yeah. Wizard.
I like it.
Nerd wizards. And it was like one of our most popular episodes ever. Yeah. So the deeper we go, the more interested people get. So hold on.
It's just my opinion, you know, based on what I see it. We Dan and I treat a lot of people at Power Monkey Camp who have gone to 3, 4, or 5 other healthcare providers. And we work with a lot of athletes that are of the higher caliber and have done a lot of different things. And I'm not saying that we have a golden ticket, because we don't, but we just have a large, large set data sample. Plus we have two very, very legendary shoulder researchers in our clinic that are our mentors and have helped us. So it's just my opinion.
Mm. Yeah. It's a very qualified one. Mm. Don't worry. We understand. I need to kind of figure this out for myself. So with the shrug, so you still meant to get elevation of the shoulder, but you're not supposed to be actively shrugging. Like, it's supposed to kind of, like, you're not supposed to be squeezing your upper trap. necessarily.
You shouldn't have to 1RM overhead flexion.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And that's what people do. Like, yeah. If you put someone's back to the wall and you chin tuck them against the head, some people literally hold their breath and swing their arms to get their hands to touch the wall to prove to you that they have mobility. And that's not what you're looking for, right? It's not that you don't want to shrug, because you sometimes some coaches teach, like, you know, tucked in armpit forward and getting a little bit of a push up on the bar, or, okay, or push up on top of a handstand push up. And I get that as a cue. But what I'm saying is that if you have to force your neck forward and drive up upper trap to get that last little bit of motion, it's probably not fluid, right? You're surviving overhead motion. You don't actually have it.
Okay. That makes sense.
Can you go back to the eccentric loading? Is that, so if you're looking to improve your mobility, like I guess range of motion in the joint or in the muscle, you're talking about basically taking that muscle through its full range of motion. So if like a lats are stiff, it'd be going from the top of the pull up all the way to like a dead hang at the bottom, with heavier than what you can do on the way up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I'll preface this with a thing about kind of going back to like why overhead elevation is limited in these athletes. And then we can bridge it into what the research says about flexibility, mobility, and what Dan and I prescribe, because there's definitely a lot of confusion about that.
Yep.
So with the shoulder specifically, we'll just keep riding this train, right? So the lats and your teres and your pecs are internal rotators, but they're also like by your side adductors, right? So the more the stronger you are and the more repetitively you use adduction, internal rotation, think about keeping the bar close for deadlifts or for power cleans or for power snatches, muscle ups, rope climbs, pull-ups, all those things tend to do those motions, right? So the more that you get stiff in those areas, as you elevate to the end range of motion, when you run out of room, there's a few things that typically happen. So one, we said head comes forward. Two, we said we shrug with our trap. But a very, very common one is that the last little bit of that lat and teres is external rotation becomes limited at end range overhead elevation. So as I get up to the top of my head, I start to spin into internal rotation because I don't have the flexibility to keep myself completely up and forward towards the joint, right? Maybe it's my thoracic spine or my lower neck, but I tend to spin into internal rotation because I don't have any more flexibility to use, right? And so we see that with people who do kipping motions or people who do jerks or people who do snatches, is they get a lot of internal rotation of the shoulder in that last little bit of range of motion. And we know that's probably not the most optimal based on how the structures in those shoulder are presented. So the question that we get a lot is, how do I get overhead motion, right, to not be painful or to have better stacking position of my joints? And then how do I keep it, right? And when you look at the research, and Dan and I have done a pretty massive review of the literature to being like, okay, what actually works and what helps, there are a few things that have been shown to improve, right, or increase range of motion, right? And I'll say the things first, then we'll talk about why. So one is that foam rolling has been completely, it's gone through like the gladiator's gauntlet of everything, right? It's gone from like, this is the dumbest thing that's ever invented, to like, everybody should foam roll when they first roll out of bed, to back down to like, okay, it's really not that helpful, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that foam rolling is bad for you, it's that the dosage and like the application of it plus a lot of other things is probably not being done well. If you look at big meta-analysis or research reviews on studies, it's like Chris Beardley did a research review that showed that like 60 seconds to 90 seconds of foam rolling per muscle group seems to help to reduce perceived soreness and seems to have a slight increase in range of motion, thoughts being blood flow, water content, and maybe modulating some of the nerve endings called nociceptors that perceive pain, right? So foam rolling in a small amount is helpful. If you do it by itself, you're going to get nowhere fast, right? It's not going to be the end all be all. So maybe hop on, get an assessment, say like, okay, these three areas are important for you. Maybe do it on a movement specific day. If it's a front rack or a deadlift day, do just your hamstrings and your lats and your forearms to get in a better position. So a little bit of foam rolling is good. And like static stretching and PNF stretching has totally gotten the whiplash too. It's like nobody stretches anymore because they're worried it's going to downregulate your neural output for CNS. But studies have shown that if you static stretch a little bit and then do a dynamic warm-up, those effects seem to go away. And there was a massive review that just came out in 2018, 2 months ago, on like looking at all these studies and saying like, okay, does static stretching increase range of motion? And it does, right? It was suggested by that massive review, thousands of people, that 5 minutes per week, so not per day, but 5 minutes per week per muscle group, for about 30 to 60 seconds, two sets, does increase range of motion over time, right? So you do see, and I don't know who volunteers for these experiments, by the way, because they're like medieval torture devices, like we said, but they put someone on a rig and do a passive static straight leg raise for 30 seconds or 60 seconds, and then they rest. They do three sets, 5 days per week, controlled studies, and people do get increased range of motion, right? So static stretching, PNF ballistics seems to help a little bit, but static stretching and active mobility seem to be more effective than, you know, just doing nothing, right? So foam rolling seems to help a little bit. Stretching seems to help a little bit, again, based off an assessment. And then other things that are shown in the research is eccentric exercises, right? So doing a heavy eccentric, like I'm thinking like an RDL for hamstrings, you know, pulling it out of the rack and slowly lowering down, having people help you up, slowly lower it down, right? Or eccentric chin-ups, kind of as you alluded to, is jump up in a reverse grip because you want to bias that external rotation, right? Jump up and do a 5 second lower in a very hollow position, get all the way to end range with a box, stand on gravity, right? 50% body weight. And that over time may help to stretch out some of the eccentric portions of your lat. So we have foam rolling, stretching, we have eccentric training, right? Strength and volume is probably the most number predictive of injury, but also of decreased performance. Is like, if you spike your volume in pull-ups and you just go crazy on rope climbs, like you might get stiff, right? Like you got to mix up your training, have a good balance of periodization. You have to have a good accessory work program to manage some of those things. And you have to manage the soft tissue. Manual therapy along with foam rolling has been shown to increase range of motion, right? If it's done appropriately. And if you have evidence-based tools that are doing the right prescription from a healthcare provider, all of those things together, right? Strength conditioning, foam rolling, eccentric training, a little bit of stretching, and then just a proper technical program, like you actually use the right technique in your workout and do the right motor control and or technical work to support that full range of motion, right? If you get a great squat when you warm up, but then you only, you know, want to be a ding dong and do power cleans that in that squat half depth because you want to go faster, you're never going to use that range of motion, and you're never going to have mechanical changes to the tissue that actually make it stay flexible. So that's what the research suggests, all those things and assessment and all those things. That's how Dan and I write flexibility programs. We give people circuits that have those things. That's how we do our treatment. That's how we treat ourselves. Like, but that's not a commercial thing. You know, that's not sellable. That's not, you know, going to give you a fancy tool that you can use and get better right now. So it's harder and it takes a lot longer and it's more patience, but that's a lot of people don't want to do that.
Mm. Okay. So yeah, it seems like a good circuit of three, like incorporating those three principles will be the fastest way to increase your flexibility.
And keep it,
yeah. So the eccentric thing, I imagine, is kind of like the strengthening aspect of the stretching. I'm just thinking of like, I'm actually thinking of a more extreme example of Juji Mufu with like the overhead squat and the chair splits. So I imagine, because there's lots of people that can do overhead squats, that can do splits, side splits, but they can't like support themselves Van Damme style, like in the, on like the chairs, for example. Like they can probably go to the floor, but then they're like resting on the floor. So a lot of yoga people, for example, right? Have they just gone way too far on the passive side of the stretching and not done the eccentric stuff and the foam rolling?
Yeah, there's probably two layers to that. One is that you have to remember that those people typically are, through natural selection, are naturally more hypermobile. So their joint capsules are a little bit more loose than the average person. And they can probably achieve, they have shallower hip sockets that are dysplastic. They probably have slightly more iliofemoral ligament laxity where they can get down a little farther than the average human. You know, like I'm 5'6", I'm not going to dunk. It's just probably not in my best gene code, but like I can work on it a little bit and get there, but I'm never going to be as good of a dunker as, you know, a 6'2 monster.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Like I was born with naturally shallow hips. I got into gymnastics. I stretched a lot. I'm a little bit more collagen than the average human. I can get down there, right? But the reason I can't actually do it is because when you get all the way down there, you're relying a lot on the passive structures of your hip labrum, your iliofemoral ligament, and your pubofemoral ligament to stretch out and hold some of that tensile load. When you do an adductor slide out or a squat that's loaded, you know, it's much, much more muscular and dynamically controlled. So if you don't have it, you're not going to be able to do it, right? But there's other ways to develop eccentric strength of your adductors to get more position in the bottom of a squat. And this is something from Brett Contreras that I've seen and a couple other people have done research, is like the adductors are very overlooked in terms of something that can limit squat depth and also that can cause anterior pelvic tilt, which can cause FAI and a limited squat depth. Like your anterior adductors, your pectineus and your longus are very highly involved in running and sprinting. And the bottom 25% of your squat is very highly adductor magnus. So if someone's squatting a lot and running a lot, happens quite often in CrossFit, right? Those things can greatly affect the amount of anterior posterior pelvic tilt that you have. And that can cause some limited depth, but also that can cause some hip issues, right? So you can get to a full split by maybe stretching out your joint capsules and passively doing it, but it doesn't mean it's going to actively show up when you try to do a split slide out, like you said, or if you try to squat.
But if you did work on the split slide out, the eccentric part of it, and did some stretching together, you would get closer to joining those two things together.
Right. Yeah. I give that out a ton, especially a lot of the young gymnasts that I work with. I mean, that's when I coach, that's what we do a lot of, is like box supported slider fallout. So like you put your hands on two boxes. If you're going forward split, say you want to get like quad flexibility, rectus fem flexibility, hip flexor, you put your hand between two boxes, you slowly lower out to wherever you can, then you push yourself back up with your hands. If you're doing it for a straddle split, yeah, you do some soft tissue work, some foam rolling, some targeted stretching. You do some slide outs with one foot on a slider, hands on the box facing forward, you slowly slide out, push yourself back up. I think the research says like 3 times a week, a couple sets of 10 with a 5 second lower was kind of the most optimal dose for those things. They were loaded, so it's hard to tell, but this is body weight loaded. So you do a couple sets of those, and then maybe you go do some side plank clamshells, some barbell hip thrusters to try to get the back of your glutes to try to support that new motion. And then you go and you do a tempo pause squat with, you know, light load or a kettlebell or a goblet, you know, based on what your coach thinks is good for your stance and your hip width. And you go through that circuit, like roll my foam roll or foam roll my adductors, stretch my adductors a little bit, some eccentric fallouts, some glute work, some tempo pause squats to try to get that new range of motion. You go through that 3 times. That would be an example of what I prescribe a lot of.
Mm. So you're still prescribing.
That encapsulates all the research.
Right. So you're still prescribing like squats, like goblet squats and stuff for gymnasts.
Oh, totally. Yeah, for sure. Well, it's goal specific, right? So it's like if it's an Olympic lifter who's trying to, like, we work with a couple people who are trying to qualify now for the American Open and they're trying to increase their mobility, you know, every day before they go in and they do their heavy sets. It's like, yeah, I do, you know, the things that need to get worked on, calves, quads, roll those out for 30 to 60 seconds, right? Moderate intensity, not killing yourself. Stretch those things correctly with a true hip flexor stretch or with a true groin stretch, and then do some eccentric warm up, and then do, you know, tempo pause goblet squats, holding the bottom, trying to maintain position, and that will warm your body up to maintain mobility for the actual squat depth. And honestly, when you look at like what Chad Vaughn prescribes to people, or what Mike at Cerberus and those guys do, and some of these really high level Olympic lifting coaches or gymnastics coaches, they're doing a version of this in their flexibility programs. And this is just taking expert coaching and opinion based on what they want to see technically, which Dan and I have just spent 4 years learning from these guys and hearing like, okay, what do you want to know more about? How can we help your athletes get in this position? Combine that with all the research, combine that with all the medical literature that talks about how do injuries occur. When you marry those three things together, those little circuits seem to encapsulate a lot of what the research says and what practical experiences makes most sense.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it's funny. I always see there's like obviously the gymnasts that are in Australia or other gymnasts I've run into haven't been trained under you, so they're obviously not incorporating all this research. They're kind of just in those traditional schools, and you talked about that on Ryan's podcast, Movement Fix. How, like, it's mm-hmm. kind of this old mm-hmm. school like methodologies and stuff. And like definitely one of the things we see is they have terrible, terrible hips and ankles. Like when it comes to, they're yep. like, oh, cool, CrossFit. Yeah, like I got toes to bar, I got handstand walks, I got handstand push-ups. Mm. They can't do an air squat. And it's just like mm-hmm. because they haven't, well, they've used their hips, but not really for like squatting and only for sort of like catching themselves in like at the end of, I don't know, a flip or a tumbling thing or whatever it is.
And they only plantar flex their ankles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So their dorsiflex.
And again, this this goes back to the soft tissue adaptations things, which is why we're such a proponent of this. And this is a huge, I mean, it's not, we don't talk about gymnastics, but this is a huge like issue in gymnastics too. Is like, again, super lax joints, they get away with cheating range of motion. But what have they done for 20 years if they're getting into CrossFit now? They've, if you watch gymnasts on TV, they point their toes, they squeeze their legs together, and they keep their knees straight, and they use their arms overhead quite a bit, right? So 20 years of pointing my toes, squeezing my legs together, jumping, running, and squeezing my quads, the direct opposite of that pattern, dorsiflexion, abduction with ER and squatting, right? All comes together, right? So you have athletes, and this is me because I went through it firsthand when I was trying to Olympic lift. I had to squat to a ball, and I had to squat to half depth and power clean for a while because I was so jacked up. Like their calves get extremely stiff over the years. Their runners get this too. Their quads, their adductors, right? That affects how much anterior pelvic tilt that gymnasts have a ton of, and that causes some impingement of their hips where they block depth, they round, and they wink. All those things are soft tissue adaptations that they've slowly gotten away with in their full splits because they have joint laxity and capsular motion. But I see a ton of gymnasts for labral tears. I see a ton of gymnasts for hypermobility based issues. You know, they're stiff in their soft tissue and super loose and stretched out in their joint capsules. That's a pretty horrific thing to add 15 times your body weight of tumbling force to. And same thing goes for an Olympic lifter. And this is what Dan and I are seeing now. If you pull a bar from the ground close to your body for 10 years straight, right? Like that makes your lats get super, super stiff and your pecs get super, super stiff because that's how you maintain bar path close to you. Mm-hmm. The complete opposite of that motion of, you know, strong lats, internal rotation, elbows together from what Chad and Jody and Mike Service and those guys like Jess Lucero too, they want to see that when you're pulled. They want to see that strong. What's the complete opposite of that motion is a front rack, right? Is external rotation at elevation with elbows tall and ribs down, right? I think it's possible that the very high level volume of deadlifting and pulling bar path type stuff might be limiting Olympic lifters front rack over time. And you see some kids that start when they're really young and they're super mobile, right? But then over time from all the squatting volume, maybe their adductors are jacked up too, but their front rack starts to go slowly and slowly and slowly, and they start to get really weird. And Chad has said that that's the number one thing that he lost as he got older and lifted more. So his front rack got really, really sticky. And when you test people on the table and you see that, you see it all the time. So now it's linked us to CrossFit. If pulling off the ground is enough, now let's add chest to bar, toes to bar, rope climbs. Like, that's why people's front racks are so garbage, probably because they're super, super stiff already. Plus they've added a lot of volume and they don't know how to front rack. They've never front squatted in their entire life. And they've always done this in the Globo gym. They've never done a real front rack with a stacked collarbone. If you see how much external rotation people have to get for a really good jerk position, man, that is super like demanding on your mobility to get there. Right. So if you've ruled out neck and T-spine and it's not your hips and it's your ankles, like, it could just be that like all the volume of shoulder plane in one motion is causing your front rack to get stiffy. And now your elbow just totally blows up, or your wrists start to get really, really crunched because you gripped bars for the last 8 months doing CrossFit.
Yeah, I actually do notice that often you see those weightlifters that have the crazy wide front racks. They're often the younger lifters.
Yeah.
Like that totally. Really good African-American young guy now is like lifts ridiculous weights.
CJ Cummings.
Yeah. Cummings, yeah. I don't know. I could be wrong, but I just do notice a lot of guys that like can move their hands out and do like the wider than their snatch grip jerk are often not like the older big guys.
Yeah. The fat Russian guys can't rack the bar.
That's my personal opinion.
They can rack when they get to 200.
What I've seen.
Yeah, it's true.
And you'll see that too. You'll see people who are really good snatchers and they get away with like a, because the more wide you are, right, like the wider your arm is out to the side, you can typically tend to get away with those limitations in elevation and lat or teres or whatever it is. But as soon as you come closer into a jerk grip, right, those things start to show up a lot more. And I don't think Jess will mind me talking about her from the first couple camps, but I worked with Jess when she was at camp because I was like watching her lift. I was like, how the hell are you getting that much weight over your head in a jerk? Like, her snatch is pretty open. She's got good thing, but her jerk was like completely forward, completely arched, completely chin out. And I was like, yo, has everyone like assessed you for like front rack mobility and like looked at all this stuff? And I just took a quick peek and like, she was super stiff overhead. When you put her in a jerk position in a true external rotation position, she was super, super stiff, right? But when you put her in a snatch grip and she's really, really wide, she really had no issue getting way out wide. And I don't know how much she's done to help it, but that was a big thing I told him. Like, man, if you like, you could clean so much weight, but you can't jerk it, right? And she always said that was a problem. And I think that's because, again, years and years and years of soft tissue adaptations and not understanding. Because Olympic weightlifters are just like gymnasts. They get into Olympic lifting. If you're good, you have really high capsular laxity. Your Bighton score is like a measurement of that. It's probably really high. You didn't get picked out of like the regular gym because you could only squat half depth and you could barely fall over. Like, a lot of these athletes that we work with that we see that were ex-gymnasts, ex-Olympic lifters, ex-something, right, have this natural predisposition of capsular laxity, and then they acquire soft tissue adaptations. So they stretch out in the wrong places. And I've seen that in a lot of lifters who are super highly successful, is that when you can do capsular testing on a shoulder and test every little piece of the capsule at different planes of motion, the hip, not so much, but you can see if someone's really lax. And if someone's really, really lax with a Bighton test and all these other things that are capsular measurements and they have limited elevation, it just screams soft tissue, right? It doesn't scream stretch, stretch, stretch. It screams like manage the soft tissue and manage your volume. And we've seen that a lot in gymnasts. We've seen that a lot in lifters. We've seen a lot in CrossFit athletes. Like, it just happens over and over and over that this pattern emerges from, again, it comes from baseball, which is a very similar sport with laxity and throwing forces.
Mm. Yeah. It is interesting now, like with the shoulder in particular, like you look at the best CrossFit athletes in the world now, pretty much all of them have like incredible hollow and like external rotation and shoulder flexion. Like, they all have amazing, like look at the top five guys, Fikowski, Fraser, Noah, Velner, like they have, they have great shoulder positions. Like, they work on it so much, and I just see so many aspiring CrossFit athletes still trying to, you know, just grind through the same movements over and over again. And I'm like, what you guys don't see and what you don't understand is, like, these athletes were where you were, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago when they weren't that good. They probably didn't have the same level of shoulder flexion, but they realized it was a huge weakness, or a coach realized it was a huge weakness, and that's all they did. I mean, some of them, like probably Noah, was probably a bit more gifted and kind of was always had it, but they definitely, like, I've seen old photos of them lifting, like they're super stiff, but you can tell over time they've worked on the positions, they've made it a priority. And you see the other people, like you said, just repeating the same movements over and over again, and it's like, your overhead position is like shit and it hasn't improved in so long. Like, you still press with bent elbows and your head forward and stuff. And you kind of know, it's like, maybe 1 year you'll get lucky and qualify, but you'll never do well at the games. And that's what we see.
Yeah. And I think there's two layers to it. One is that it's biomechanically more efficient to have a stacked position with proper external rotation. And you can put more weight over your head and you can do more proper handstand pushups. And with a stacked position because you're using the entire kinetic chain. You're not really, you don't have any bottlenecks or weak points. Like we call them the basics of the basics, right? Like the basics of a jerk position is, you know, the basic ability to have your capsular tissue and your shoulder moving well, all of the soft tissue, have proper cuff strength that's matching the amount of prime mover strength, which is really hard to do, and have proper strength balance, right? And the reason that some of these athletes are, again, this is just theory from seeing some people like them, is the reason that they're so dominant and the reason they consistently do well is because they're probably expending 0.05% less energy every single rep than you are.
Yes.
Right? So all of those perfect technical movements overhead, perfect running form that they've drilled and drilled and drilled. What do you think Power Monkey Camp is? Power Monkey Camp is coming and learning all the proper basics of all the things that you need to do right in order to be more successful, right? So all those, think about 0.05% and doing a long grinding workout, right? You're going to have more steam in the tank at the end of the day because you're not fighting every single overhead position, right? You're not battling for every rep overhead position. The same thing happens on the injury point of view, right? Every time you put your arm over your head in a horribly stacked position, you're probably putting some more stress on your cuff. You're probably putting a little bit more stress on your low back because you're super extended an arch. Like every rep you do in a super big arch squat that's not properly, you know, in proper position of your hips and your feet is probably putting a little bit more stress on your hip. So not only is it biomechanically more performance-wise more advantageous to take a huge step back and figure out why you don't have these positions and completely overhaul your program to get there, it's also going to be a really big longevity thing, right? Like people that tend to do well, you know, in workouts like that are more efficient with each movement and they're moving consistently throughout all of their reps, right? And they continue the same pacing, but they also just have, you know, the ability to be like, okay, it's, I need to do the harder thing that's longer and more grunt work. I need to go all the way back to the beginning and fix my basic handstand position. I need to face my basic, you know, push-up position. And we have a lot of very high level athletes that come through Power Monkey Camp, you know, in the last 4 years, like studs, and they get to Dave's station and do proper handstand drills. And it's like, oh shit, this just got real. You know what I mean? They get to Chad's station with an air squat and just proper front rack position. Like, oh my God, this is brutal. You know, a lot of the high level athletes are just durable. They're just savages and they have a mental toughness that we can't even fathom, but they also seem to find other ways to get the job done. Sometimes that catches up to you and it, you know, makes your labrum start to fall apart, or it makes your elbow blow out, or it makes your back really get a huge herniation or something like that. So,
I just think the incentive for them to do that work is just not there. It's different when you've signed to Chelsea FC and they're like, cool, we're going to do like capsular rehab work on your left hip because like it's not working properly when you go to shoot. That's why you can't, you know, get enough rotation on the ball or it pinches or whatever. And you're like, cool, I'm getting like $1 million a fucking season. Like, of course I'm going to do this stuff. They're like, all right, CrossFit athlete who actually is broke as fuck, let's do this. And you're like, oh, but I kind of need to go do this comp and I need to like get stronger and I need to do this to win and that. And it's like, there's no time off because they feel the pressure to always perform to try and, you know, be better for the open, qualify for regionals, because it comes around so often.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, yeah, it's a very important and topic to talk about, is like that really comes down to a few things that we try to hold as values at Champion. One is, we're not trying to sell you something. We're trying to help you. And, you know, we're not going to just shove on you what we learned at a weekend course and try to see if it works. We're going to really dig down to the root of this and figure out, like, okay, why does this keep happening? But that can't happen until you establish trust and relationship with that athlete. And you say, like, you know, Dan, myself and the other champion providers have given away an ungodly amount of money just because we want to help people and because we value that they're trying to do something super cool and that we want to help them pursue their goals. And we're honest with them, you know, like, and that doesn't fit for everybody. I've had a few athletes who I offer a free eval to, and I give them a full program and like, it all goes well for the first couple of days. And then, you know, it's actually a little bit of grunt work and it's not doing certain movements or it's holding off on certain things or modifying or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I never hear from them again. And it's like, okay, well, that's your decision. That's, you kind of made that choice, you know, but you got to realize that a lot of these high level athletes spent 10, 15 years in a sport that absolutely drilled into them perfect basics and perfect technique and a mindset of just grunt work that's insane, right? Like traditional gymnastics upbringing, you spend an hour out of your 4-hour practice doing a warm-up and basics until your eyes start to bleed, and then you're allowed to start doing events. And when you get to the event, you do another half hour of basics before you're allowed to start doing skills.
Yeah.
Right. So three-fourths of your practice is warming up and doing basics.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? Every day, 6 days a week for 15 years.
Mm.
And it's like, yeah. That's hard. It's just really freaking hard.
Yeah.
And I've heard Olympic lifters and what they make their people do for warmups. Like, people move the barbell at 40 pounds the same way they do at 140 pounds, or the same thing they do at 340 pounds. Like, it's the same movements over and over and over. And we've taken that approach to the rehab process. It's like, okay, well, you want to make it to regionals and you want to make it to the games, then I definitely know that that handstand's not going to feel great at the end of a workout multiple days in a row. So you can either put in the time now and talk to Dave Durrani or talk to Chad and fix this. And I work with Chad on some programming and with some other people about how we help them. You can either take a big step back and fix these things now and do the very boring, long, slow grunt work it's going to take, or it's not that valuable to you and you're going to skip steps because you think that money, fame, and social media is more important than actually fixing these things. And you're probably going to eventually have something go wrong, whether that's just a poor performance that you don't make it or you get hurt, right? And then now, you know, we're going to eventually fix it because now you had labral surgery and we have 6 months on our hands to work with where we're going to do it anyway. So it's like, you know, people really don't want to hear that. And Dan and I try to do it in a polite way, but it's like, man, we just want to help you. And like, you're paying me to give you my opinion based on all the research that I've done and who I've seen and whatever. And, you know, this is my opinion. We got to go back and we got to fix these things. Or like, you have to have a couple extra things put in your program, or you have to not do pull-ups 5 days a week, right? You have to not do handstand push-ups 5 days a week because your shoulder's a little sensitive. And it's like, until we cross that bridge and we have a cultural eye-to-eye talk about what values you have and what morals you have, it doesn't matter what foam rolling, flexibility, cool drill you see, it's not going to work. And you're going to think I'm a shitty provider because I didn't give you the honest answer. And we're just going to you're wasting your money and time. You know, I don't want to hurt you.
Yeah, I'm fucking so glad you said that. And you said it in such a, so many people need to hear that. And I wish I might just take the soundbite and just send it out to a few people that I know. But no, it's very honest. And I think the honesty is the best way. The truth is,
again,
the best
this
way.
Is not, yeah, sorry to interrupt you, but
yeah.
Yeah, I just think it's not, people think that we have some special secret. You know, we have a lot of people who come to us and they want the golden exercise. They want the perfect program. They want to say that they're doing this. And I don't think we have that. I think that Dan and I have just learned how to get punched in the face by life more than other people in terms of what we do and what doesn't work. And we learn from it and we grow from it, right? So we have mentors that we work with. We have a staff of 20 people at Power Monkey Camp who we learn from every single time we go to camp. And we've done a bunch of stuff. It didn't work. And we're trying to tweak and we're trying to do it. But we're super honest with people. You know what I mean? It's like, they ask us our opinion about everything you possibly heard about this commercial and CrossFit. Every single person asks us about it everywhere we talk and every camp we go to. And we say the same thing. We're like, hey, you know, we've tried. This is the stuff that we're doing that's evidence-based and that seems to work based on our perspective. I bet that a lot of that stuff works for people. And I'm glad that it's out there because it helps a lot of people who wouldn't better take care of themselves. But at the same time, it's like there's a lot of stuff that people are just selling and they're not trying to help people. And it gets super frustrating for us because then they say that physios don't work and they say that like PTs don't work. And it's like, no, it's not really necessarily true. It's just that people don't want to have an honest conversation and people don't want to establish a caring relationship that you want to help people. You know, they want to just be at the games with this person or they want to like take photos with this person. And it's kind of disheartening to see that because if I was an athlete in their position and we've seen a few other athletes go through it, it's like, I wouldn't want someone to be trying to lie to me to say that they're just working with me. I want someone to tell me straight up how it is and, you know, really deal with it. You know, because that's what's more important.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how we try to operate.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good. It's really good. It just reminds me of a story. One of my mates was telling me, because he used to play really high-level soccer for the state in Australia. And yeah, it's like we don't really have that in CrossFit where people will be like, okay, cool. So like you can start practice with everyone else. Like I need 200 unbroken juggles. The assistant coach is going to watch. Like once you get 200, you can play. And like people just wouldn't train that day because they couldn't get 200. So they have to go home and practice. And if there was just a way to bring some aspects of that into CrossFit for certain athletes, I think it would be more beneficial for them than what they realize. But, you know, the problem is everyone gets into CrossFit as an adult and adults have egos. And then it's very hard to tell them. Yeah, that's right. It's very hard to tell them like, hey, you know, if you want to achieve your goal, like go do this silly thing and you can't do anything else till you do it. It doesn't really work like that. So
yeah.
It's kind of like takes a special athlete to sort of accept that and be like, okay, I'm just going to work on my shoulder flexion for 5 days in a row for the next 6 months until it's perfect.
Yeah. And I think that as all things happen, CrossFit's too young to make any of these things. Like the baseball world has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of studies to support these things. So it's easy to make these assumptions and say like, well, the data suggests this based on really high controlled studies. But at the same time, like CrossFit's so young, it changes all the time. And there's no one person involved in the equation or the group that doesn't have some blame to take in why it's not working well. And that's like, that I really try, we try hard not to gossip and try not to chop the legs out of anybody, because we've made all these mistakes that we talk about, you know, the wrong application or the wrong viewpoint. But like, you can make the argument that like some of the coaches out there maybe are just like bypassing the right information, and they're just like kind of going willy nilly. The athlete's got a huge ego and they don't want to listen to constructive criticism and like, you know, understand a different point of view and take insight to self-reflection. The physios are trying to fake it and they don't have a true gymnastics background. They don't understand Olympic weightlifting, or they're not willing to have a conversation with the coach about what's really going on. And you can make an argument like surgeons have some issues too, right? Like, everybody's got something that they got to take on. And the reason that Power Monkey Camp is so successful is because you have 10 of the best coaches in their domains sitting around a table asking each other what they can do better. And that's pretty insane, right? Like, when, you know, Dave Duraney's asking me to talk to his group about like shoulder flexibility and how he can get better. And then Chad wants to work with someone. And then Chris Hinshaw, I was like, yeah, like, I love what you're saying. Like, but like, what do you think about this? Like, it's crazy about how much information gets exchanged at Power Monkey. And every person is probably one of the more successful people in their area of expertise, but the most humble, right? And they're willing to take constructive criticism. And that's why they've been on staff for the last 4 years. And if that doesn't exist, it's a very painful, expensive, and frustrating process to try to help somebody.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's cool. All right. Well, Raf, you've given him the questions ahead of time.
Yep.
Yeah, fantastic.
I did.
All right, fantastic. So we'll dive into these four questions before we make people lose absolutely all hope. There's only a shred of hope left, so we'll savor it for another day.
No, it's all good. There's plenty of things that can go well.
Okay. Okay, but we're here to talk about what you're not doing right, because that's how you're going to get better. So, Dave, what is, or if you had an opportunity to sit down and interview anyone that's alive today, who would you choose and why?
Oh, that's alive today? I thought it was anybody.
Why does this keep happening?
I think people don't read it well.
Okay, it's probably my fault. Right. All right. So my person that was dead was going to be Ben Franklin, because he's a boss. But alive today? Okay, I got it. I got alive today. So I would pay very good money to sit down with Robert Sapolsky from Stanford, who's a lead researcher on stress neuroendocrinology. I'm considering going back to school for stress neuroendocrinology and epigenetics to study the youth athletic issue in terms of sports. He's like probably my spirit animal. I've read all of his work. I've read all of his books. He inspired me to write a chapter or two in my book that just came out a little while ago to like really dive into that. So I would, I'm trying to figure out a way to go to UCLA and then go to Stanford to see him. But I would, if he's listening, he's not. I'd pay good money to hang out with him.
This is the book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Is that the book?
Yeah. So Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. He's also had Behave, which just came out. And he was also part of the stress neuroendocrinology textbooks, the handbooks that came out. One was on like emotional regulation and one was on like neuroarchitecture and stuff, which I've just torn apart and I love.
Okay, so if you were to give us like maybe three takeaways you got from reading his stuff that you didn't have in mind before you kind of found his work, what are three big things that he sort of taught you?
So that one is that stress, the stress system we have now is very much evolved from an evolutionary point of view, from a day that when we got chased by tigers and had much bigger worries than traffic and cell phones. So like a lot of the things that we experience day to day are rooted in evolution of like primal level, you know, sympathetic drive, don't die, allostatic load, like that's one. So it's like very weird to understand your own brain about how that works. Number two is that the stress response is universal based on evolution. So like back in the day, it was just tigers and, you know, weather, but now it's like getting nervous for a presentation recruits the same stress response. And this is actually a really cool point of why I wanted to study this stuff, is because I've watched very high level athletes who know how to control their brain before events and before big competitions perform better, because I think they're not burning through their resources that they use when they work out. Cortisol and glucose are used when you're worried about an event, very similar to how when you're doing the event. And that's like a pretty cool thing to think about. And then, I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent. There's an epic Navy SEAL test where they have to swim 50 yards down and back in the pool. The people that can do it are the ones that can keep their heart rate down and control themselves, not the people that are more fit because they burn through all their energy. So that's a cool test.
So you got to swim 100 yards, which is like 30 meters.
That doesn't, I don't know the exact number, but it's down and back in a massive pool.
No, I think it's a 25 meter pool.
Yeah.
It's 50 meters underwater.
Without coming up. Without coming up for air, I read about that.
That
is tough.
No, it's hot. It's hot. No, it's fucking hot. Yeah, it's crazy hot.
He said the guys who drown though are the ones that are freaking out on the deck beforehand because their sympathetic drive, they're burning through cortisol, that's anaerobic energy they could use under the water. So it's like I work with some athletes and coaches that I'm always like, I think that you do well sometimes, not because you're more fit, but because you can conserve your energy and you can conserve your stress neuroendocrinological response, and your brain has adapted to that and you have more gas in the tank because your mental game is so strong. I think there's a very real link between the thoughts, the beliefs you have, and the true neuroarchitecture of how your stress system outputs metabolic energy. So that's why I might go back to school. But the third one is the concept of epigenetics, which I get made fun of a lot for studying, but it's that our genetic code has some inherent, you know, static nature to it, but it's very much changed by our experiences and our thought process and like what we do in our daily life. So you can become more or less sensitive to stress based on your thoughts, your actions, your belief, what you do, your daily habits. And like just the same way that you can adapt to physical fitness and metabolic stuff, your brain and your genetic output, like for receptors, can change based on your experiences and things like that. So I think that stuff is like, if nothing else has blown my mind more in terms of like the problems that are happening in gymnastics right now, what CrossFit athletes go through, and like all of youth athletics being crazy and like the parents screaming at their kids from, you know, the stands, is like that concept of like what that does to kids and how some athletes are savages and can get through the most brutal things on earth versus how some just completely flop. And I think a lot of it comes down to like the genetic changes and the output of the system that happens over multiple years of training. But that's all from Robert Spolsky's work and some other people that I just like love.
Yeah, that's cool. Mm. Yeah, coming back to the swimming one, I remember once this was sort of like a self-discovery moment. Like I always used to try and test every time I'd go for a swim in my home pool, like how many laps I could do underwater. And my record was like six. Like I couldn't get six. Like six would give me like a headache, like for the rest of the day, like so deprived of oxygen. And then one day, I wasn't even trying for it, but what had happened was I was like doing the laps underwater, but I was like half doing something else. Like I was trying to prep to show someone something. The point is my mind was completely somewhere else. And I got, what I'd realized is I'd got to six laps and I wasn't thinking about where I was. And I was like, oh my God, I'm at six. And then I was like, I should just keep going. And then as soon as I knew I was over the thing and I started panicking, I got to eight, but I was in the same position where I was at six. Like where I would, where I'd usually be, but it was because I was so relaxed and I was thinking about doing something else that my body, like my energy consumption was so low that I had all this extra oxygen. And then I kept trying to replicate that, you know, but obviously it was in the back of my mind now, like, oh, you're trying to relax. So I'd burn the energy. But it was that one brief moment where I was able to just like completely check out and think about something else. And I smashed my thing by like, what's that? Like 20%, 25%. Like it was nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that Chris Hinshaw would be a good person to probably validate this. But the thought is that when you're not, because remember we said the stress evolution cycle, you can consciously recruit a stress response right now, right? If I right now, it's like, yo, there's someone behind you with a big ass hammer, like you'd already start having stuff in your brain, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So like you can consciously recruit the stress response and start burning up some of that energy. And you're exactly right. O2, glucose, and cortisol exertion are all like very much sympathetic drive factors that when you start to worry about like, oh shit, I'm going to drown right now. I'm going to drown. Like I'm going to die right now. Like your brain's already like, through the roof. But like the athlete that can stand in front of the barbell and be like, nope, I'm okay. Like, this is going to be uncomfortable, but like, I'll be okay. I'll do the best that I can. And I'm right here right now. You know, those athletes tend to seem to have more gas in the tank. And I think there's a unknown link for why that exists.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
From like a genetic point of view.
Yeah, cool. So the second question is, what is a routine that you have in your day or night, wherever, that you feel is essential to the success of the day?
So I would say it's probably the first hour of my day, from like 5 to 6 usually is my phone's on airplane mode. There's no technology. It's just old music, but there's like light music and it's like just journaling and reading, reflecting, coffee, shower. Like it's totally like I'm dead to the world. And, I've gotten really scared that sometimes I'll miss an emergency, but the people who know me best understand that I'm probably not available. But that hour, sometimes it's only 30 minutes if I'm really, really busy. That hour in the beginning of my day, I really find that if I like take care of myself and get myself in working order, like I can really handle any stressor of the day and I can handle like a lot of craziness that happens between the clinic or coaching or like other things.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah. Cool.
That's cool. What type of meditation do you do? You say meditation?
What type? Sometimes I do. Yeah. Sometimes I just do, not really just structured meditation, but it's just like literally just sitting for, you know, mindfulness awareness, but like trying to control your thought train and focus yourself back. I used to do a lot more religiously, like 20 minutes every day. It's bumped down to like 10 or 5 sometimes. But for me, like, yeah, I don't know, like the way I come up and the way my family is like music for me and reading is very much like super meditative. So like if I get a personal development book and I'm journaling or writing and I have music on with a cup of coffee, like, I'm like, I hit my full stride, man. And there's been some, honestly, there's been times that I've gotten so lost in it that I've like, oh crap, I got to go to work, and I'll get to work without my laptop because I totally forget.
Wow.
Like, sorry. I'm just like, and like, I've also had times where I've used that and it's triggered like 6 to 7 to 8 hour work sessions where I'll rip through like an entire textbook chapter or two, like in a day. Cause I'm just like, so in it.
That's happy. That's like flow. It's like proper flow.
It's exactly like flow. Yeah. That's what I've found, how to put myself in a little bit of flow. And I think that airplane mode, coffee, and some music is seems to work with me. That and really long brutal hero workout seem to do it too.
Yeah, that'll
I don't know why
that'll do it. Okay, cool. And then third question is, what is something recently that you held as a belief but you've changed your mind on?
Yeah, so I think that I was gonna, when I originally read this, I was thinking about like more of like a medical technique or not, but it's really a little bit more global than that. It's that when I was younger, fresh out of grad school, I thought that it was more like you have to be on the cutting edge of finding the new shiny toy and you have to show it off fast if you want to be on the front edge of science and the front edge of research. And so it's like, yeah, I used to think like, oh, if I can just like predict the weather kind of thing and like know what tools are coming out or know whatever, I can, you know, get more attention and make money. And I quickly found out that like that's what everybody does to try to make themselves well known. So I figured out it's just an unbelievable, stupid amount of grunt work, and humility is what really sets people apart, right? It's not fancy new toys. It's not new tricks. It's not bragging about yourself on social media and how awesome you are. It's like day after day after day of mind numbing grunt work. And the athletes that I've been fortunate to work with, I hate name dropping, but they do that more than anybody I've ever met. And I'm appalled at how much they can just like act in a way that's in line with their values. And they have blinders on to social media and to the world. And they just fucking hammer away day after day after day after day with the stuff that's super boring and super dumb. So I try to take that same approach to my academic studies, and the work that I do is like, just doesn't really matter what people think or not. I just do my own thing, and you know, wherever that takes me, so to speak, that's good.
Yeah. I'd say unless like actually being active on social media is like the thing you're selling, like, I don't know, Gary Vee, for example, whatever.
Yep.
Usually those people are like hiding something. They're not actually as successful, or they're insecure, or like they're not as, you know, doing what they say they're doing. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's usually more like at the beach this weekend with my boyfriend, it's more like, I'm secretly unhappy in my relationship. Please like me or comment so I feel better. Like, it's messed up, but that's like what's happening for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually took 6 months of total darkness for social media. I went away, and like that's when I was writing one of my books, and I completely went black for social media because I was using it the wrong way. And I studied a lot of Gary Vee stuff, and I had it in the wrong bucket, like he says. Like, I was doing it for the wrong reasons. And now that I'm back, I mean, I run a digital education business. Like, I'm like, social media and information sharing is like what I do to help people. So like, now I just have it in the right bucket. Like, I auto post my stuff with CoSchedule, and I reply to comments because I believe in that. I talk to people, I email everybody back, I comment everybody back. But like, it's not like endless scrolling and like comparison to people.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's definitely a trap to fall into. That's cool. Okay, cool. Leaving the listeners with a great book and a quote as well, if you have one.
Yeah, it's funny that you said Gary Vee, because that's actually where mine comes from. So
the book
was a toss-up for me. Both of Ryan Holiday's books, Ego is the Enemy and Obstacles to Way, I've read 3 or 4 times on audiobook and person. I go back to all the time. I've gifted it more than I can imagine. And then there's a book called The Road to Character by David Brooks, which is pretty awesome too. Those are books that I've read, but the quote is not, it's actually from one of Gary's videos. Obviously, it's like viral videos. And I actually have it on my wall right here. I think I wrote it down. So, oh yeah, it says, every second you spend thinking about what someone else has is time you're taking away from something you can make for yourself.
Mm. Yeah, I remember that
one. Thought that was, it's funny. He was like talking to some, it's like an epic viral video that he had. It's like some girl calls in and talks about like the Kardashians and how she's not successful and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, why the fuck are you looking at the Kardashians? He was like, that is like the most ludicrous crap I've ever heard about.
Yeah.
And, so I had a huge ego when I was a younger provider, and I cared so much about like what other people were doing with their lives, all the way from like business stuff to like medical stuff. And I should be doing this, all the way down to like, honestly, like people in relationships and people like getting married and having kids earlier in their life. And I was just like super paranoid that I wasn't doing that. And I was like, man, every time you sit there and you look at like an ex-girlfriend or what somebody else is doing or somebody else's business, you're just like completely stabbing yourself in the foot in terms of like your energy and your output. And I think that goes back to like, you know, framing your mind to have supportive beliefs and stuff is about like controlling your environment, like not hanging out with certain people, not looking through social media too much, like to kill yourself, not having poor habits, like taking care of your health, like all that stuff was a big turnaround for me in the last few years that I think has really skyrocketed the amount of work that I'm able to do and the amount of, like, you know, personal joy I'm able to have with people.
Mm. Okay, I have a question for you. I've been chewing on this recently. If you, maybe we could add this to our questions. If you didn't have a business and you just worked like for someone else, right? Would you still have social media? Would you see the value in it?
Yes, I would, because I think that when properly done, social media is one of the best ways to positively impact people's lives. I think that when social media is approached in the right bucket and with the right filter, it can be a tectonic shift in like humanity and culture, right? Think about like all the Facebook groups that happened in Hurricane Harvey that saved people's lives because they had a way to find their family. Think about the millions of dollars in charity donations that Facebook raises through advertising, you know, and through things like that. And I think there's a lot of things about social media that are really, really, really good. I think it's probably 20%, but I think that the 80% is comparison, toxic, just people spewing hatred in the comment section because they're unhappy with their lives, and just an ungodly amount of negativity and hatred, which is really sad to see. I would use it, but I would have very strict rules against how I allow myself to use it in my daily life, you know?
Hold on, I gotta just, when you said all the negativity, this is what someone posted on our YouTube video today. You two faggots can suck my dick and fuck off to Rainbow Nation. Like, what's wrong with this person? What's wrong with this person? That is so aggressive. That is so aggressive.
And you really like if you can get past the red zone of you just your blood boiling and getting mad, like, and you really think about it, you're like, wow, I really feel bad for that person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I can't believe that, like, you got to a point in your life where you have to do that to justify your unhappiness.
Man, I went straight past blood boiling. I went to straight for, I feel really bad for this person. That you have to spend a portion of your day thinking about it and actually typing that up and sending it to someone else and for the whole world to see. Like, it's embarrassing. It's very embarrassing.
Yeah, I get a lot of that. I mean, it's been hard in the last 5 years. I've gone through a lot of stuff in my personal life that's been pretty brutal in terms of, like, I wish this never happened. But then you realize, it's still cliche, right? You realize, like, kind of like builds you into perspective. Like, having it allows you to have gratitude and perspective and empathy for people that wrong you or people that hurt you, because you're like, okay, if you are at that level morally where you could do that, or you can, like, engage in that activity, or you can, you know, drown your sorrows away at a bar and try to pick up a chick at a one night stand, like, that's how you feel good about yourself. And, like, man, I feel really bad for you, because, like, this is gonna be a long ass 40 years you got left in this life.
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard to do that, but that when you put blinders on and you write out your values and you put blinders on to what matters to you, I try not to judge people. I observe them and say, does this fall in line with my values? And I act accordingly. I really try really hard not to judge people.
Mm.
And I think that's given me a lot of perspective.
Mm. No, that's cool. Awesome. All right. Well, you've got a few things that people can go to. Firstly, your Instagram. What is the handle, the Instagram handle?
Shift_movement_science. That's my company, my educational platform, and my, like, the business half of my life.
Awesome. And you do have a product for people if they want to get some of this programming and suss out what it's like. Maybe they've got some shoulder issues. It's Peak Shoulder Performance. Where can they get that?
Yeah. So right now, all that stuff is actually hosted through Dan's website, because I'm undergoing, like, a huge remodeling thing. So there is a website on the Shift Movement Science homepage, has a store link where you can follow through, or you can go to Fitness Pain Free and look for the product, which is Dan's website. We've both just dumped all of our knowledge into one product about, like, how do you get out of shoulder pain? How do you heal, like, not heal yourself, that's not a rehab product, but, like, how do you, like, get back to doing Olympic lifts and gymnastics, the progressions for it's like for medical providers, coaches, and for athletes.
Mm. And is it like something that you would develop your own program out of reading it? So you'd be like, hey, these are kind of my issues. These are, like, the stretching and the foam rolling and the activation that I need to be doing.
Yeah. So it's an online course, is mainly the manual module. I think it's got like 16 hours of content. We went way too aggressive with it, but it's got like, we didn't want to, like, have a shitty product, right? So it's probably like 4 to 5 modules that go all the way from, like, why does shoulder pain happen, to, like, what do medical providers need to do? And then, like we have an Excel spreadsheet that has the exact progression that we use back to every plane of motion. So if you want to get back to overhead pressing and, you know, handstand pushups, it has a progression from the most basic exercise all the way through to that. And then it has the same thing for, like, benching, dips, muscle ups. That's the program that Dan and I use in the clinic for rehab. So it's made to be, you're out of pain, your rehab is coming to a close, but you don't know how to yet get back. And how do you work with a medical provider to design a program that, you know, allows you? We see so many people that go try, get hurt again and go back to rehab, right? Or go back to surgery. So our goal was like, okay, this is how you get back to all the stuff you want to do with a roadmap, not just like, hope this works.
That's cool.
Nice. Yeah. It's awesome. You guys are doing that sort of stuff. Now I will like to think that we'll bring Power Monkey Fitness Camp out to Australia at some point. I don't know when,
absolutely,
but I know there's interest. We know a lot of you people listening have either done it or want to see it down under. So we'll try and sort something out. But that's probably a conversation we need to have with Dave. So we can sort that out in the future. So if that's something people are interested in, let us know, and we can sort that out. But for now, Dave, thanks so much. Unfortunately, we won't be able to see you when you're over in Perth. But have a great trip to Australia. Enjoy
you from the air.
Yeah, that'll be perfect.
Do some mining. Contribute.
Yeah. Solid.
All right. Thanks so much. Oh,
thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Awesome.
See ya.
Project, there it is. Coming out of nowhere, Dave Tilley just dropping some serious heat on the podcast. And I'm definitely, it's not often that I walk away from a podcast where I'm like, you know what, I'm going to start doing some of that training. The stretching stuff, 100% I'm going to start doing some of that training. So I'm very interested in some of the results I can get, because I have tried some stretching protocols in the past and they really haven't worked, or I haven't felt like I believed in them, or I didn't stick to them. Whatever the reason, I am going to try this, and I will, of course, be always posting the results on our Instagram. So stay tuned for that. Stay tuned for more content from podcasts on our Instagram as well. And remember, guys, today was supported by Beyond Macros. You go to beyondmacros.com. You can get your free nutrition coaching consultation to start when you head there. And also Activate Nutrients. They have new products in the works. We're very excited for those. But for now, you can go to the staple, the Activated Nutrients Daily Superfood. You can get that on Amazon if you're in America, and you can get it from the website. Both are going to use the code OfferMMP, and both are going to get you 20% off. Go get the subscription as well if you haven't got it already. All right, that's it from us. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you, Project, for tuning in again to another episode of the My Muscle Project. We release an episode every single Monday. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, the My Muscle Project, to stay up to date with everything we're doing. And if you have some time, leave us a review and a 5-star rating on iTunes.
And don't forget, we have a second show of the week, The After Show. So it's no longer a rest day on Thursdays. If you have any questions for Lachlan and I for that show, head to themindmuscleproject.com/theaftershow. And if you ask a question, we'll answer it on the show.
Thanks again so much, Project, and we'll see you all next week.